Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. The sole focus of tonight's program is the Terry Kath Experience. Terry Kath, who we lost far too early due to an accidental self-inflicted gunshot, was the guitarist, one of the vocalists, and one of the founding members of the band Chicago. His name is not as widely known as, say, Jimi Hendrix, but Kath was actually Jimmy's favorite guitarist. He was also mostly unknown to his daughter, who was only two when he lost his life. Tonight I'll be in conversation with Michelle Kath Sinclair to find out about the journey she went on to find out more about the father she never knew after finding a box of photos and home movies. The result is the documentary, The Terry Kath Experience. Growing up, you know, you can't go through life not hearing the music of Chicago.
This is true.
No matter what era of Chicago it is or was, no matter what radio station or no matter what store you're at, you will hear Chicago somewhere.
You will hear it.
So due to your age, you could be easily someone who's the prime age for the way less horn section, David Foster, powered ballad era, the 80s Chicago. But being your father's daughter, maybe you were drawn to the earlier Chicago, the CTA sound. So where were you as far as liking the music of Chicago?
It's funny, yeah, growing up as a 90s kid, and I think every era goes back, right? Retro sound of, typically people go back 20 years. For us, it was like, oh, the 80s are cool, but the 70s are really cool. Mm-hmm. And kids were getting into Led Zeppelin, and I just remember growing up, we really liked Led Zeppelin. That kind of rock sound, the Doors, you know, things that were very showy. Because we were trying to be 70s cool.
Yeah.
And so, Chicago had a different sound than any of those. And then there was 80s Chicago, which a lot of us grew up with.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. Where Chicago fit in for me would have been really different if I wasn't what I call a Chicago kid.
Yeah.
One of the kids that our dads was in Chicago. Because you have a different point of view on the music, on the take. And especially for me, when you have my father, who was part of the early original Chicago sound, and then abruptly had to leave us, and the whole thing changed. So I was getting fed, you know, what my peer group was listening to, what was out on the radio and getting fed to us. But then what people would say, well, you know, Chicago and your dad and your dad this, and did you check out this with your... I was probably exposed a little bit more unorganically to my father than normally. And so paying attention to certain things and experiencing Chicago in a really different way than probably even other Chicago kids, I say, would do. I don't know. I guess I, you know, Chicago was always there. It was a part of my life. Always. And so I got to pick different songs that meant different things to me, whether my dad was in it or not.
Okay.
You know?
So you do have some of the Love Me Tomorrow kind of.
So great. They're such epic, amazing ballads.
Yeah.
I love it.
God bless David Foster. What kind of involvement after your father died, what kind of involvement did your mom continue to have with Danny or whomever from the band?
Yeah. I think for her, as I grew up, I understood her position a little bit more. Because, you know, your parents are always your parents. But then when you get older and surpass the age of whatever big things, like for her, when my dad passed away, she was 22 and I was just turning 3 years old. She was a young woman. I was not that mature at 22, you know. So when I started having kids in my 30s and looking back and being like, oh, God, she was going through a lot. I don't think in her mind she felt a sense of like empowerment as a woman to stand up for herself or for things that were in the house. Like, she was very much like, these people lost someone great. Take this guitar, take this, you know. Okay. And so her involvement with the group, as I started getting older and she remarried and things like that, we probably fizzled out a little bit, but she kept very close with the women.
Okay.
So there was certain women that were around at the time that we stayed in contact with, and I grew up with those kids, and they are still really important women in my life today.
Oh, wonderful. Good.
I call them the wives of.
Okay.
The wives of. You have the Chicago kids, yeah, and you have the wives of, yeah, and then, you know, we kind of grew up together. Yeah.
I'm glad you said it, because actually, as a guy, it wouldn't sound good coming from me. Oh, there's the guys, and then there's the wives.
The wives.
And,
I mean,
but actually, in the film, you very much see that. There's this camaraderie, yeah, and I'm not saying it as a, you know, as sexist or, you know, whatever.
Right.
I'm saying that the guys in the band hung together, and the,
yeah,
wives,
I mean, there's
the
no women in the band, so what do you? There's right. No other way to paint it, really. And yeah, the women. One thing we never did, and a lot of it was budget and timing and money and just needing to get the film done and get it out there. And I always had this idea of getting all those women back together into one room and interviewing all of them, because each woman's perspective and point of view and stories they had to tell about my dad were so different than the male perspective.
Sure.
It was your dad, what a sweetheart. And it was just a very mothering woman's point of view, or the things that he did for them is very different than what he was doing with the guys.
Or, yeah,
you
yeah
know, like that kind of thing. And like I was saying, like the wives of, the women were a mothering group. The guys are on the road, and so the women were together with the children, playing house, waiting for the guys to come back, and doing things for us, outings and cooking together and all these things. I really wanted to put that in there, but when it comes down to your storyline and your budget and what you have,
yeah,
you know, it's like,
yeah,
I'm playing two part. I'm playing the daughter on the journey, wanting to know my dad. And to me, the woman's perspective was really important, even though in the end, we didn't really have time or the budget to pull it off.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, you can't let it go.
I could see maybe that's becoming a bonus disc sometime.
Ooh.
Maybe this is down the road. And we'll actually, I have questions about that later on. So how long was this process? I started to ask this earlier. Is it 7 years or so on this?
7 years from the time that we did our first Kickstarter campaign.
Okay.
But the idea and the seed of it brewing is years even before that. Because
okay,
I knew I wanted to do it, but I'm not a filmmaker. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to get there. And so I marinated for a long time with the film. And it started off as me just wanting to tell a story about my dad and expose him as an artist.
Mm-hmm. He is an underrated guitar out there as far as people even knowing his name. But
yeah,
we'll get to Jimi Hendrix in a second. But
I mean, he's not even in the top 100 Rolling Stones top 100 guitarists of all time.
250624 is brilliant. I guess that's the landmark signature Chicago song for him. I could never figure out what the title of the song was because I was stoned. Is it 25 or 64? Is it 25 or 624?
David Fleming in conversation with Michelle Kath Sinclair, daughter of the late Terry Kath, guitarist, vocalist, and founding member of the band Chicago, though we also just heard from Joe Walsh. We are speaking about the documentary she directed, The Terry Kath Experience. More at terrykath.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 FM, streaming live at kvcrnews.org.
Courses at UCLA documentary film department, which allowed me to make my 5-minute teaser.
Searching for Terry?
Yeah, it kind of started forming everything, and we started learning, and I was getting to talk to a lot of really good documentary film directors and producers, and everyone was like, okay, you know, this story could really get lost because, you know, no one really knows who he is. And, you know, people were saying things to me like, if you were really famous, then we could sell this. If you were a famous recovering drug addict that was trying to find their dad, this would be just, you know, everywhere, and people would love the story. So I had to find an angle, and I realized that my angle was really my journey of discovery. So yes. I had to put myself in front of the camera and take the journey and just kind of put myself out there.
Yeah, very much a subjective thing. And it would be tough. You would have to be objective at many points. But, I mean, you are searching for the father that you maybe or maybe not have accurate memories of. I'm speaking of this turning around during some family vacation.
But yeah.
Your mom swears you were maybe 6, 8, 9 months old at that point.
Yeah, when people ask me if I remember my dad, I do have these weird memories. Obviously, as I get older, they seem not real. But when I was a little kid, that memory of being on a boat at my grandparents' cabins in the lake and my dad driving the boat, and it was a very vivid memory. And my mom saying to me, how can you remember that? You were, you know, a baby in my arms. And it's weird how, okay, so now that's not a dream. That's something that happened. And that's how our brain works, I suppose.
We alluded to this earlier, the idea to make this film, going through a box of photographs. I know I read this somewhere, maybe at terrycath.com. I have to say, terrycath.com. I'm surprised that nobody had that domain name. Actually.
I acquired it a long time ago.
Okay.
So,
okay. So many fans that they could have
easily
taken.
Yeah, so terrycath.com, I kind of took it over way over 10 years ago. Probably 13 years ago, I just took the name, threw up some images, and tried to start figuring out things to do with it.
Okay.
And then realized that, oh gosh, you know, how do I have a forum and how do I get people engaged? And then it just, things progressed on the internet so quickly that I realized Facebook is the place.
Yeah, actually, it is.
So I kind of threw the fan page onto Facebook. And then at the time that I acquired terrycath.com, there was a guy that had a very extensive Terry Kath fan page with many articles. That was the only thing out there that you could get any information from. And then partway through making my film, he was like, I just don't want to maintain this and pay for the domain. Like, if you want this stuff, you can take it.
That's
so
sweet.
The terrycath.com, if you go into all this information about Terry, is all of his articles on there. Yeah.
Okay.
And I just took all his stuff and kind of intertwined it in. And so it's kind of become this cool place, I think,
that even
if Facebook closes or I never post anything again or never have the opportunity to talk with lovely people like you and keep things relevant, I guess, that can kind of be there as this little capsule.
I hope so. It really
life.
Is.
Yeah.
And my God, I can't imagine being you and getting this veritable treasure trove from this fellow that used to have the site. Talking about going through these photographs and whatnot, I'm sure there had to have been a couple of stages. It's not like you were looking at the photos and said, okay, boom, I need to make a film.
Yeah.
There had to have been the teenage years, and then when it actually started happening.
Totally. And you, because you look at these pictures all your life.
Right, right.
And you see things all your life, and you grow as a person, and, you know, for as a kid, you're like, oh, that's my, you know, that's how you associate with this person that's not around. And then you kind of grow up, and I think there is probably a combination of frustration about people not really knowing who he was. But everyone that talked to me was like, he's the best guitarist of all time ever.
Yes.
And then growing up as a woman and having a family and having kids and getting married and realizing how important their father is to them and having us working together. But my mom didn't have that and I didn't have that. So who was this guy and who is this guy to my kids and all these kind of things. So it was definitely a combination of maybe picking that up again. And even though when I got my dad's reels, home footage converted over, I had a baby, I just got married. And so that was a first for me. Seeing the reels and seeing the man behind, you know, he wasn't in them, but he was filming this. So it's like his eyes, the world through his eyes. That definitely was a changing point because you're like, whoa, I can make really cool movie with this stuff. And it's got some interesting point of view and perspective, and what does it mean what he was filming, and what are all these other drawings mean that he had in this box.
I went to the screening in Hollywood, and one of my takeaways was that there wasn't so much footage of him, especially of him speaking, but then thinking about it well after the fact, yes, most of the footage that we saw, that 8mm kind of shaky whatever stuff it was, that was him, his eyes, his view. And so that's another thing, putting yourself in his shoes at the Caribou Ranch or whatever, which, believe me, we'll be talking about that as well.
Yeah.
So then going from wanting to make the film to encountering Tony Papa and Jordan Levy.
Yes. So my co-producers and the guys behind the camera really were important and integral to making this film happen.
I'd say.
Because our budget was so small and it really was a labor of love, and finding the people that were going to help me make it took a while as well, because I don't know anything about cameras. I needed to be in front of, you know, it's like I wasn't going to try to go learn camera and sound in order to make it. I wanted it to be a legitimate film that could be a real documentary. And so I already knew these guys through groups of friends I was hanging out with. They were good people, and they got excited about the film, and they were just like, let's do this.
Gotcha.
And we all kind of got on to the same vision and started to film stuff with the idea of what the story arc was and what my vision was of what I wanted to get through. And they stuck through it, I think, to the end. And like years would be passing and I'd be like, sorry guys, I just had a baby. Like I can't do anything for 6 months. And we'd get to a point where I'm like, great, I need to like fundraise some more and, you know, things like that. But yeah, basically the film couldn't have been made without their time and effort that they put in with me.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Michelle Kath Sinclair, daughter of the late Terry Kath of the band Chicago. You're listening to KVCR Arts on 91.9 FM, streaming live at kvcrnews.org. We were speaking about the documentary she directed, The Terry Kath Experience. More at terrykath.com, and more with Michelle in just about 3 minutes.
He was so ahead of his time, and I heard a story, and said that Hendrix said that when he saw Terry play, he said, that guy is the best guitar player I've ever heard in my life. So, you know, let's just start with getting a thumbs up from Jimmy and work exponentially forward. That's kind of how everybody felt, that he was like the superstar of the band, if you will. I would hate to be the guy that had to walk in afterwards and fill that slot, because it's unfillable. There was nobody been like him since.
I really did want to know if you had any expectation of what the narrative would be, say, as opposed to the case of gathering all this material and then saying, wow, what story is this telling?
Yeah, I mean, we knew that obviously there's my journey of discovery, meeting with these people, and then my dad's story. You know, how did he learn guitar? How did he become so good? What bands was he in the first place? The scene that the whole band of Chicago came out of, all those little Chicago fan questions or Terry Kath fan questions. So it kind of started with his stuff.
The reels,
finding
the
these
photos,
reels, finding these things and being like, okay, well, I only have these guitars, but there's like a whole bunch of other guitars. That, where are they?
Yeah.
And so I was really pushing this question with each interview. If people knew where his things were, could we film them? Could we add them into the film somehow? Do you have photographs? Do you have pictures? Do you have, you know, like, hey, there's my first birthday party. She's filming. Does she still have those videos? You know, things like that.
All right, yeah.
And I knew that his iconic guitar was something I wanted to find too, because I didn't have it. So even though I had a vision, and the boys also contributed to the story arc because they were really watching the journey.
Yes.
I had to remove myself and let them film me so I could watch the journey. So they were possibly seeing things as it was happening that maybe I wasn't even seeing till we were editing.
As a viewer, the film does start to have this parallel storyline going beyond a documentary and a search for Terry. It became this search for this one very specific guitar.
Yeah.
There's this one that's just covered with stickers. There's a Chicago Blackhawks logo and a lot of these little round things. They're pig nose amps. He must have gotten the deal on that roll of stickers and just covered it. And that's the one we ended up looking at. It's this very iconic one. So was that something that you knew from the beginning, looking for that guitar? Or is that something that sort of developed? Everybody you talk to talks about the guitar, and then you're like, yeah, where is it, man?
Yeah. No, I was definitely wanting to search for this guitar.
Okay.
Because it has been an online conversation way before I even started filming with the fan group and people remaking it and people asking me where it was. And I just knew that even though it looked cool and I thought it was cool, and I knew it was important because I was getting told it by the fan group a lot. And there was so much, there's people making websites on how to build it and how to make your own stickers. And I mean, all this was happening before the film, that I knew that if we could find it, it would be cool.
Yep. Oh my gosh, yes. That's a Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of thing. That's just... When you went into an interview session with some of these folks, whether it's maybe one of your uncles or one of the old bandmates or whatnot, I'm curious how much of it was actual Q&A, stuff that you had prepared, or perhaps it was just telling whomever to just, hey, go with memories. Hey, spill it, uncle. I'm recording.
Yeah. Well, obviously you have certain things you want to hit. And also, since my father left so tragically, you knew inevitably you had to get to this place that was probably not that comfortable or nice for people to talk about. So I always started with happy things. My first question pretty much was, why do you think he's important or relevant? Because I knew that I would ask that also to the famous guitarists who may not have personal stories. And then we could kind of start with that. And then we kind of got into what's your favorite memory, and everyone's was different. I mean, it's funny how much stuff doesn't make the film that I thought was cool because it talked about who he was as a person. And a lot of it related to living with him or what kind of roommate he was or things like that. So some people would start a story and you'd have to question that. Or some people felt like they had to let you know something or let me know something about my dad that was important. So there was questions I wanted to hit because there was things I wanted them to say. And of course, there's the Jimi Hendrix question about Jimi Hendrix saying my dad was a better guitar player than me. So it was important for me to try to get as many stories about people saying that, because that, again, could be hearsay. Oh, Jimi Hendrix said, or Jimi Hendrix said, and Jimi Hendrix isn't here and there's no one else that heard it, but maybe these people, so let's hear your stories. And then there's what people say off camera, and then there's what people say on camera.
Or when they don't know you're recording. Or what, Oh my gosh. But that's, you know, I've seen the film just a few times, but I'm really, really wanting all the cutting room floor material of stuff. I mean, that's just, that's kind of where I live anyway. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 FM, streaming live at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming in conversation tonight with Michelle Kath Sinclair, daughter of the late Terry Kath, guitarist and vocalist of the band Chicago. We were speaking about the documentary she directed, The Terry Kath Experience. More at terrykath.com. So with the parallel storyline that we were talking about, the search for the guitar with the pig-nose stickers all over it, I think that's what people call it, the pig-nose guitar.
The pig-nose guitar.
Yeah. And this, by the way, is a weird combination between a Gibson and a Les Paul as far as the action and whatnot that happens with it. It's technically things that I don't understand, but the sounds that, well, actually, the sounds that your father made with his guitar, nobody understood. We have Joe Walsh saying it, except that's very much comedic effect when he's saying it. Staying with that, when you went into the home in Florida, I believe it was, spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Skip ahead.
You found it. Yes. Did you actually, you found it there over and over. During the film, we have you calling somebody. He's still not answering.
Yeah.
And
I still haven't talked to that guy.
Still haven't. Okay. So when you went into the home in Florida, was this your grandma or great aunt or who was
that? Yeah, so she's my grandma. She's my dad's second wife.
Okay, gotcha.
They married when I was a teenager, and she's been my grandmother since. So since my grandmother's passed away, she's kind of been the caretaker of all things in his house.
Okay.
Hence those things.
And so when you got to that house where you found the guitar, did you know it ahead of time, or was the camera crew truly following through somebody just to see it may or may not happen?
I did not know it ahead of time. So also in the hunt for the guitar, it's funny because we have, you know, the three of us working together, and Tony knew what I was getting at with this question, and Jordan didn't. And he was kind of like, why do we have to keep talking about the guitar? And I was like, trust me, like, there's a thing here. And so as we kind of got thicker into it, it was a decision about who are we going to see first. And who do you think has it? And who... Because it's like if you discover it before you see these other things, then you have to pretend you're still looking for it.
Yeah.
And so I kind of knew my uncle didn't have it. And so when we went to Chicago, I was like, oh, shoot, if he does have it, now I have to pretend see all these other people.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no hunt, you know. And then so when I went to see her at that point, though, because I kind of had a feeling it was there. And so I was like, it's either down to these two people. It's either down to my dad's roadie, Hank, has it, or my grandpa has it. Because my uncle doesn't have it. My mom doesn't have it. I highly doubt random people have it because they'd probably be flaunting it.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But
yeah,
I have. Yeah. Or it's like truly lost and that's even interesting again. So since I could not get Hank's son to sit down and show me, you know, originally it started that he was going to kind of open up what Hank had, because Hank got a lot of stuff from my dad. They were very good friends, and he was very, from what I understand in the conversations I had with Hank's son before Hank passed away, he was very like, please take care of Terry's things, which are really important. And so for me, I was really excited because I was thinking, look, I don't want your things. Just can we film them and take pictures of them? And it's just really cool. Yeah. Like, what do you have? And not only that, but the intimate relationship that my dad and Hank had, there must be other fun things, like maybe notes or weird, who knows?
A stolen ashtray, something.
Yeah.
Random.
Some silly paperwork that is just paperwork, but is funny now. And so I was kind of bummed we didn't get to do that. And so I was like, I really hope he doesn't have the guitar, because that would suck if we never even get to see it. So then we went to see my grandma, who had been saying for years to me, there's your dad's stuff here. Please come and get it, because if I ever pass away, I just don't want it to be confused with my grandchildren or anything what's in here. Yeah. Just come get your dad's stuff. Also, it makes me nervous. So when my grandfather died, she literally just didn't touch anything and waited for me.
Behind. You'll see this going behind. I'd like to compare it to going to any of our grandmother's house, and you'll go to a precious memory and hang on. It's behind this row of dresses that's even, and that's where it was.
And so many people tell me that this is their favorite part of the movie.
Okay.
Because a lot of people that didn't know my dad or aren't fans of Chicago are like, God, this is amazing. And this is the best part, because how funny is this, you know, the grandma's house? And like you say... Digging around in your grandma's house.
Yeah.
The day after that, when we filmed, I was getting ready to leave her house, and I was like looking through the room. I look under the guest bed that I was staying in. There was another guitar. She didn't even know about it.
Oh.
And she was like, I'm embarrassed because I swear I'm not a dirty person. Like, I clean, but I never get under there. I just, like, she just send the vacuum under, and that was it. So she was literally just pushing this guitar case around with her vacuum
case, for
years. And I mean, I guess maybe it just reaches to the center. And we pulled it out, and she was blown away. Literally, we found another guitar. And so we got to comb through her house. And I did one last, I was like, let's do one last comb through your house. Make sure there's nothing else.
That's funny. Some people might, oh, here's another photograph that we didn't have.
Yeah, no,
here's
another guitar.
There's six more strings to take home. Wow. This is truly incredible. And, you know, by the way, it was interesting to note that the narrative through the film, it continued whether or not it had the questions to guide it. That is to say, this very linear, let me ask you this, here's the answer. Here's me asking another question, there's the answer. It flowed through this documentary by showing the Mystics, and then the big thing, these are the bands that your father was in before Chicago. Okay, we alluded to Jimi Hendrix a second ago. Now, why would we want to throw his name in there? We just mentioned that he is that Terry is Jimi Hendrix's favorite guitarist. That is just incredible, I have to say. And there's a story in there where Jimmy actually came to see Chicago. Well, yeah, and Chicago was opening up for him at some point, too, I believe.
Yeah, but, I think the story in my film that is told is what leads them to open up for Jimi Hendrix. When they were a new band, new in LA, they were still CTA, Chicago Transit Authority, and they were like the new kids on the block. They went on tour with Jimi Hendrix and opened up for Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin.
Wow.
I got some really good stories from Peter Cetera off camera about my dad and Jimmy on this tour and how they were just like two peas in a pod.
Wow.
And then didn't get it on film because they were, I guess, a lot of it did revolve around drugs. And for me,
there was,
I didn't want to shy away from the topic of drugs. But for some people, I understand also that they don't want to talk about it. So right. I, honored that.
It's like it was a great time, but we don't want to glorify it either.
Yeah, you don't want to glorify it either.
Yeah.
But
it was a great time.
I was just looking to get like the stamp of approval on this Jimi Hendrix thing because obviously, when you're like, yeah, Terry Kath, you're like, who's that? And you're like trying to explain Terry Kath. And then you're like, look, Jimi Hendrix really. And then the minute you say Jimi Hendrix, that sentence.
That's verification. Or that's your providence.
Like, oh, really? Yes. And it changes. It's like right away people are like interested.
You have various people speaking, various guitarists or folks with this band or that band. You have Steve Lukather in there from Toto saying, well, let's put it this way. He's Jimi Hendrix's favorite guitarist. Let's just start there, okay?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And I know at this point, this is the time that Jimi Hendrix comes backstage and he says, you guys are mother fathers or something very close to that.
Yeah.
And oh my God. And this is that club appearance, which led to them traveling and opening with Jimmy.
I guess so. Yeah. Okay, because I guess he walked in and then after that, he was like, let me have them open up for us. And I hunted for a flyer. Or anything that said Jimi Hendrix opening with CT. I could not find the flyer. I think that's how unknown they were at the time. And maybe it was a small tour as well, but I just could not find even a flyer or a picture or anything like that.
Wow. We just mentioned that you have a variety of musicians giving praise to Terry in some fashion. It's sort of interwoven with the rest of the story. The repeated phrase being, he's the fastest I've ever seen.
Mm.
And Joe Walsh, we mentioned this earlier as well, as much giving comic relief as he was giving accolades. And half of it, I'm curious, you hear some of Joe's answers, and part of me would want to be, okay, great, I'm trying to get something serious here, Joe. But on the other hand, it was just funny. You had to, I couldn't remember it, I was stoned.
Yeah.
I think he said that at least once.
I think by the time I interviewed Joe Walsh, his interview was such a breath of fresh air, because up to that point we had interviewed all the members of the band, Danny and Robert and Jim and all the horns and everyone in the band, and people are very reserved. I don't know if it's because they're still on tour and they have things to promote and they're trying to just give a very fair good interview, or if I'm Terry's daughter, so they don't want to say anything offensive.
Sure, right.
Or, they don't know how much I know, so they don't want to talk too much about the drugs or whatever the behavior was at the time. Joe just told it as it was. And I just remember looking at the guys, looking at Tony and Jordy, and being like, thank God, finally, someone's just laying it out there. And those lines he said were like, literally, I was waiting for somebody to just say it.
Yes.
That's just how it was back then. We were all getting messed up. It was how it was. And a lot of people were lost to drugs and alcohol in that time.
I think Joe mentions, he said it was a great time. At least that's what he was told.
Yeah.
But one more thing about the speed on the guitar. Yeah. Since several people, Jeff Lynn says this, Joe Walsh says this, many people say this, fastest I've ever seen. Something about the speed, this goes beyond the tapping and tricks, as it were, like that. His speed is melodically up and down the fretboard. If people need to find some video of old Chicago, just go to the Tanglewood 1970 concert. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of things there. But so the folks that we do hear from sporadically during the film, beyond those that were directly associated with the band, Steve Lukather, Jeff Lynn from Electric Light Orchestra, or Traveling Wilburys, depending on your time. Now, I think Joe Walsh and Terry, they were friends during the time of Joe's James Gang era, something like that.
Yeah, they knew each other back then from just touring all the time, because I guess at the time those bands were coming out of the late 60s garage band scene. They all kind of knew each other and they were touring together and they hung out a lot, I guess. I'm assuming touring was a little different back then than now.
Yeah, I imagine so. He was in a Volkswagen bus until you got the airplane, and that was about it. Well, how about Lukather? How did you end up getting him? And
I was looking for anyone that had something to say or some kind of connection. And so a lot of it was banging down doors or can you connect me with that person, and letting my mom, who knows a lot of people in that area, hey, can you ask them?
Gotcha.
Hey, and Steve Lukather just got really excited and he said yes. There was people that said no. I asked around a lot. And some people said no, some people said yes. I recently just met the guitarist from The Doors. I was at a charity event. Danny Serafin was doing a charity event.
Okay.
And he was there as well. And he's like, come meet him. And
yeah.
He's like, oh man, I knew your dad. He was the best. Loved him so much. And I was like, dang it. Why didn't I meet you when I was looking for guitarists?
Yes.
I would have loved to have interviewed him.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that would have been
incredible. It's hard to find people because that happened a lot. Like you hear after you're done filming, Ozzy Osbourne loved your dad or whatever. And you're just like, dang it. And I was trying to find as many people as possible. I really wanted to have just all these random guitarists saying all these things because we don't have Jimi Hendrix saying that. So to me, finding people that could talk about him in any way, as many people as possible, was cool.
So when you were starting this, I mean, going back to the beginning, I think I glossed over this question then. As far as how it started, maybe one of the first conversations probably had to have been with your mom, going through her address book, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, not really, because she wasn't really in contact with too many of the guys in the band.
Oh, yeah, they're just the wives. Yeah.
Yeah, and so when we were forming everything together, I think I had been in contact randomly with the guys in the band throughout the years. And so once I realized I wanted to do the documentary, it was all about just keeping in touch and seeing how people felt and if they would sit down and do it. And it kind of started there. And then the minute you talk to one person, it's usually like, you should talk to this person. And then you just kind of start building your relationships that way.
It was just like Hendrix, really, just wanging up and down that neck like a loony. It was just brilliant. He was like the most wonderful guitar player. He was the fastest I've ever seen.
And David Fleming in conversation tonight with Michelle Kath Sinclair, daughter of the late Terry Kath of the band Chicago, though we also just heard from Jeff Lynn. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 FM, streaming live at kvcrnews.org. We are speaking about the documentary The Terry Kath Experience, more at terrykath.com, and more with Michelle in just about a minute. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming in conversation tonight with Michelle Kath Sinclair, talking about the Terry Kath Experience, a documentary exploring the life of one of the founding members, guitarist and vocalist of the band Chicago. Michelle, were you ever tempted to pick up a guitar?
You know, not really. Growing up, I wish that I was forced to stick with piano because maybe that would have led to something. But music was something I loved very much. It was really important to me. I was obsessive with finding new music and collecting music and eventually became a DJ.
Yes,
so.
You are a DJ currently.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Let's go ahead and plug that so that I don't forget later.
Okay.
What are you doing? What's the company? Where can you be found? Can we hire you for a wedding?
Yes, you can hire me for whatever you would like. Well, maybe not whatever. I go by the name DJ Lady Sinclair. My website is djladysinclair.com. Okay. We started a company just to be able to have other avenues to promote so I don't have to always be talking about myself, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a DJ. This is so I started a company, Haute Mobile Disco, HAUTE as in Haute Couture. To be able to have a platform to, you know, share music, promote our services where we can be hired to DJ and have other people to work with. I like working with people.
Okay.
Yeah.
And a website, ways to be in contact or part or hire? Or?
You can just go to my website, djladysinclair.com.
Simple enough.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. I would love to hear, whether this is, say, Mike Campbell or anybody, really.
Yeah.
I'd love to get something that's just so behind the scenes that people couldn't even find it on the bonus features on a disc somewhere. This is just, I know there's things like Danny. This is Danny Serafin, the drummer. This didn't, I don't think, make it into the film, but it's in the preview with him saying, do you want to go there?
Do you want to go there? Yeah.
And I don't necessarily mean, hey, let's go there.
It was something that when we got in to the editing room. I mean, there's a couple moments like that. So that one where I'm asking Danny, we finally get to the point where we're going to talk about my father and how he passed and how this affected people. And yeah. He was like, do you want to go there? And it was a really intense moment where you're like, I have no idea what he's about to say next. This could be the moment where he tells me something I've never heard before. In reality, what comes next is what I know and what I expect to hear. So it's not a surprising moment. So in the editing room, even though we use that in our Kickstarter campaign video to entice people, when it became part of the movie, it was anticlimactic. And I know that Tony and Jordan, after I left, searched for that. What everyone wants is they want me to cry. They want me to be like, oh my gosh, you know.
Yeah.
But the reality is he goes into like what made the film is your dad did drugs. We all did drugs and we did this intervention. That's where he went with that question. Yeah, there was no juice. That was the problem. And that's kind of why it got cut. And I knew that anyone that had followed the journey of making the film was going to be like, wait a minute.
Time goes on. I realize it's what you mean.
One thing that is totally on the floor, you know, you kind of have to pick what songs you're going to talk about, but sure. Is Color My World.
Oh, yes. Slow ballad, piano,
yeah,
driven.
Color song. My World, which is probably one of people's most favorite songs for my dad's voice. Mm-hmm. He didn't play on it. It doesn't have a guitar solo or anything, but his voice in that song and everything about it is amazing. Jimmy tells the story because I ask everyone to kind of tell what's your favorite Terry Kath song and do you have any stories. And Gershio had come up with Color My World and everyone thought it was so cheesy, apparently. Well, this is his story. And
okay.
Totally
excellent.
Paraphrasing
okay.
Again.
Okay.
But I love this. He says that, you know, no one wanted to sing on it. They kind of thought it maybe was a little bit corny, and they're like, just get Terry to do it. So he called my dad in, and he's like, ugh, fine. And Jimmy says that he just lies down. He lies down, and they put the mic up to him. He sings the song, and he's like, okay, am I done? And then walks out. And that was...
He's laying down in the studio with the as time goes on.
That's what Jim said.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That's literally and figuratively on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
In that one, so. Wow.
I felt like maybe, possibly, what I was doing is bringing closure to other people who had this sore, this open sore of this person that left. The other roadie in the film that I interview who had a lot of insight to my dad's personality was really emotional about meeting me because we had never met. And he was apologetic about it. And I feel like by the time we kind of got to the end of the interview, you have closure. So I felt more like that, like, maybe it was a process for everybody, but maybe more for them than me.
True, yeah. So many of them. You see them. Do you see who she looks like? Look at that smile. That's
yep.
Terry. That's. I'm sure you'll continue to always hear that. A few more things before we wrap. Let's talk about Caribou Ranch for a second. I mean, just even what that is. Some of the hip, savvy people out there will know what this is, and the people that have floated literally and figuratively through there. Tell us what the Caribou Ranch is.
Well, I always know when someone hasn't watched my documentary yet when they don't know what Caribou Ranch
right.
is.
Okay, there you go.
So my friends or whatever, and I'm like, Caribou Ranch. And they're like, what's that? And I'm like, you haven't watched my documentary because you would know.
I know it because I go to Boulder usually once a year, and I've gone up to Netherlands just
I mean, obviously anyone that's listened to any of the bands that came out of Caribou Ranch knows Caribou Ranch. Mm. Caribou Ranch is this place that is a wonderland and... Disneyland, I would think Disneyland for any musician in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he bought, you know, hundreds of acres of land in the Netherlands and built these cabins and built this recording studio in the barn. and people were flown out there to record their albums. You know, Joe Walsh and Earth, Wind & Fire and Chicago. And I mean, it goes on and on and on and on.
It goes on and on. Yes.
And they get to live there and film and play in the woods. I mean, it's like a dream, I would imagine.
I guess we even have footage of your dad and Cetera and some of the other Chicago guys riding horses and just having a big time, performing a barbecue concert. I think these were kids from UC Boulder, maybe, but something like that. That's just an amazing place. And yes, everybody has gone through there. It is closed now.
Yeah.
But that's something quite interesting that you and your mom and maybe your
kids,
you were quite literally last to be at the ranch. Like they were closing. Yeah. Showed you around, you filmed, you were leaving, and they were actually locking the gate behind you.
Yeah.
You were truly the last.
So it was interesting because I kind of imagined that maybe Caribou Ranch would be the end of my film because I was really kind of connecting that my dad was this kind of real down-to-earth guy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
He didn't really like the fame. He didn't really like touring. He didn't really like any of that. And he think he found a lot of joy in being in Caribou Ranch because he could just record music and be. There was no fluff. There was nothing.
Right.
He could be a rugged guy, man's man.
Yeah.
And so originally the idea was that we would go spend a week. They'd give us cabins and we'd hang out, and I could really feel the vibe of Caribou Ranch. And I was going to take my mom back there, which was going to be a very emotional and crazy experience for her, which it was. But I originally was going to stay there and we could get into that vibe. And then by the time I got the money together to go, it was like, oh, we sold it. Like, if you want to record, you better get here now, but you can't stay there anymore and blah, blah, blah. And so I was like, oh my God, guys, we need to go like next week to Caribou Ranch, like right now. And at first we were like, what? That sucks. We won't get to stay there. That was going to be the coolest thing. And then we realized that what we actually had once we got there was that we were there during the final week of them being on this place and how epic and historical that was within itself. I've heard that they've left the studio exactly as is.
Good, good.
So I've heard.
What did not get answered? This is kind of like, this meal would have been good if you had this.
I mean, I don't think that I can say anything was not answered because I think maybe what I was looking for, if anything, was stuff that I didn't know because people were always telling me, oh, you don't want to question this. You don't want to open this Pandora box and find out. And I was like, okay, so what's there that I don't know? And maybe people just thought that my mom wasn't as open with me. I was very young when he died, but I always knew how he died. Nothing was a mystery. So nothing really kind of went unanswered to me. I think that if anything, it was more just maybe there's more people I haven't met yet that they were important with each other or I didn't get to have a conversation yet with.
Gotcha. Okay. So I haven't seen the DVD version of this yet.
Oh.
You can.
Well, let me give you one.
Yay. You can get this live.
I brought one for you.
Sweet. Oh, well, you know what? Then we can get this answered right here because the special features beyond the film itself. Oh, there's you and Joe Walsh in the back. He probably remembers this photo because this was recently. But hearing Joe talk on this is just a blast.
Oh,
yeah, man, I just didn't. Yeah, we were all stunned. Okay, so anyway. But the special features, you got bonus home video footage and director's commentary.
Ooh.
So as you're going through this, so your commentary, what's some of the home video footage that...
The director's commentary bit is, I guess, for about 10 minutes or however long it is, I just let my dad's home video footage play. And I kind of say in the beginning, just put on some music because there's no music. Put on your favorite Chicago jams, whatever, and let it play in the background, and I'm going to talk you through some stuff. And I guess if you get bored and watch it over and over, you could mute it and put this interview on as well.
Yay. I mean, no, you won't get bored. I actually, in getting ready for this, beyond watching the Terry Kath Experience a couple of times on Amazon Prime, it is there.
Yeah.
Where can a person order the DVD,
by
the way?
You can order this online. So Amazon, obviously.
Okay.
I have seen it through Barnes & Noble's, and I think they made a couple deals that way. But definitely online. I know that when it first came out, it sold out, and then they had to restock it.
Nice. That's a good problem. Yeah. That's a really good problem.
That's if you want to order the DVD. International, we don't know yet.
Okay.
That's my number one email every day.
Okay.
We're working on it.
We'll get there. Almost to wrap, has this been a springboard for other films or explorations of any kind? I know that Tony would love to tackle Caribou Ranch. Yeah. But how about you? What has this planted the seed for, other than, no, not another 7 years?
Actually, the exact opposite. I'm a crazy person, but I would love to take on another film, hopefully not for 7 years. And I can by no means do it at the capacity I did with this film. But I would love to do another film. It's hard when, you know, you want people to take you seriously, because this could easily be the only film I ever direct and produce, and I can go back to doing whatever I do. So trying to get people to recognize you and say, hey, I could tell your story or make your project, is something I'm still banging on doors for. And also, it's hard because this film was a lot of favors. A lot of people gave me deals for their services. And for that reason, it did take a lot longer. I think to be able to do something else, I'd like to streamline it. I'd like to get it done quickly. And I'd like to work with someone else's budget.
You need a budget, yeah.
But what I am learning is that already since this film came out, meeting and talking with people is what takes a long time.
Sure.
So when people are like, it took X amount of time to make a film, they might have been talking about it for 2 to 3 years before that. And that's what I'm learning now too. Yes, I would like to do another film, and hopefully it doesn't take that long.
Can you see it being connected to any of this stuff? Like maybe The Wives, that kind of...
Yeah, if an opportunity like that came my way, I would jump on it. But in the meantime, I mean, yeah, there's loads of ideas and things like that. It's still that question. How do you do it? How do you make it? I'll never call myself a documentary film director until I make two more.
Some of the folks that you connected with during the making of this film, I'd love to hear of any that maybe remain a connection to this day. Some newly discovered friendships, and to use the word connection in another way.
Yeah, I mean, all the people I met and interviewed in this film, I remain connected to this day. And you'll at least email once or twice and say hey. The folks at Caribou Ranch, so John Carcello, who takes us around, you know, you just love that guy.
Yeah.
And you're just like, I love you so much. So when I see him in the film, it makes me happy. Pretty much all the people that, not just on the film and not just some of the behind the scenes people I had to talk with, like Joe Walsh's road manager.
Okay, yeah,
great
right,
guy. Right. Love this guy. Or some of the fans that get in touch with you all the time and let you know, hey, this is happening. Have you checked this out? Have you checked that out? I mean, the amount of people I've met along the way have been amazing. And I think forever connected, even if it's going to be an email once a year, twice a year. So I guess the point there would be, what really is the takeaway for me is a gift for my dad. I became a filmmaker. I went to college, basically. He gave me that, and I got to meet all his friends and really get to know him as a whole person.
It's really cool because this really goes beyond just finding out about your dad. Because it's one thing to find out, oh yeah, he liked to fish. But these guys actually, in that figurative situation, would take you to where you fished, where he fished. And you were actually in his footsteps.
Yeah.
In his guitar case. That one that said Terry's favorite.
Yeah.
I guess I'd just like to thank you very much for coming in. This was a bit of a drive.
Thank you for having me.
We could have done it by phone, but this is so much better. I'm so glad to have had you here.
I like meeting face to face. Thanks for having me.
You know, as a creative person, he wasn't done yet. And he was up and coming, and a lot of people were noticing him. I miss him.
Tonight's KVC Arts has been devoted solely to the Terry Kath experience, in conversation with director Michelle Kath Sinclair. More at terrykath.com and on Facebook at The Terry Kath Experience, a documentary. We also heard comments from Steve Lukather, Jeff Lynn, and Joe Walsh. That was Walsh just a moment ago. Rest in peace, Terry Kath. He would have been 73 on January 31st, 2019. Thanks again to Michelle Kath Sinclair, in other circles known as DJ Lady Sinclair. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, Isel Quapio, Sharina Wad, Jesse Rosales, Tony Papa, and KVCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music heard on tonight's program was that of Chicago, the exception being the music behind us now, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVCR's programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.